Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we're talking with Lauren Michelle Jackson about her book White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue, and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I've got to say, that's such a great title. It really jumps out at you when it's on a bookshelf or something.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's kind of a mouthful, but you know, I think the main title is supposed to be the real eye catcher.
Could you tell us a bit about how you became interested in writing about cultural appropriation?
Yeah. So I've always really been interested in, I guess what I call like cross-racial aesthetics and racial aesthetics more broadly, particularly in pop culture, but also elsewhere. And I've always just thought it was, I think the way that we read race or interpret race or even ignore race in a lot of the cultural objects that we, in mass cultural objects that we encounter on a daily basis, has always been way more interesting and weird and ambivalent than I think we give ourselves credit for, or that maybe mainstream publications give credit for. And so my interest in appropriation particularly arose out of the, the Miley Cyrus moment in 2013, during the VMAs of that year, when it felt like that was sort of when the term really exploded in headlines, from like gossip rags to the New York Times. It was like everyone was like, had realized this is the term we use now to describe this thing that has really been so eternal to American culture, but really exploded in this particular way in both pop culture and then also online culture, digital culture, and Miley Cyrus is kind of the avatar for that. And that also happened to coincide when I started doing a lot of public writing while I was in grad school. And so it I'm not a reporter, I don't have a beat, but it did become something that I was really interested in. And the more I wrote about it, I think the more developed my thoughts became, until it materialized into something that could form the basis of a book.
Yeah. In a lot of the examples in your book, it seems like there's this kind of simultaneous dependence on a racialized aesthetic, but then also a denial that that is what's actually going on, right?
Yeah, I think we're really good at spotting the sort of obvious obvious instances of masquerade. So a white girl twerking on an MTV stage, like that's very obvious, that's very overt. Like Justin Timberlake, you know, wearing cornrows or something like that. Like these things are kind of very obvious. I think we're less accustomed to thinking about the ways that we as consumers of culture and just like people who live in the world and interact with all different kinds of people and cultures through the internet, through television, through billboards, all, you know, mass culture, yada, 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 like how we sort of unknowingly incorporate that stuff on our bodies, and how in a racial framework, the unevenness between how dependent we are on Black aesthetics and Black cultural production, and the disparity between like who actually gets to be known as like the tastemakers of American culture at large.
Right. There's one sentence in your book that I particularly loved, which is you write, leading discussions about appropriation have been limited to debates about freedom and choice when everyone should be talking about power. Could you kind of unpack that statement a little bit for us?
Yeah. So the way the conversation tended to go and probably still tends to go, because it's catchy and clickable and easy for a sort of inflammatory headline, is that, you know, pop star does something bad, you know, they should not do this, like, let us all gather around and shame them or whatever, for these, like, you know, more overt instances of appropriation. And it really makes it seem like, yeah, it really makes it seem like it's a like a matter of like a choice that this pop star, and it is in some sense, of course, it's an aesthetic choice. You know, no one told, or, you know, Katy Perry didn't have to put on a grill. Like, no, you know, that wasn't like a thing that she absolutely had to do to, you know, she's already very popular by the time she's making videos like This Is What We Do, I think is the one I'm thinking of. But it's like the issue, you know, the issue isn't that she necessarily chose to wear a grill in the video. The issue is that when she wears a grill, it's quirky and it's weird and it's fun. Whereas the, you know, the kinds of people who sort of made wearing grills into a cultural, like made it into something that is like cool and beautiful and wonderful and hood, you know, those people don't get to get the cultural cachet. Those people are going to be profiled in the grocery store, in the convenience store, on, you know, in their own neighborhoods for, you know, things that are going to be, you know, become symbols of the, you know, the degradation of like Black culture or something like that. Right. So it's, but like going back to the sort of issue of, like, I hate to use the word intellectual property, because, like, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't, I don't study law in any way, shape, or form. I kind of think of it more in cachet, but it does eventually get to that larger idea of like who is like sitting at the top of not just like record labels, but fashion labels and fast fashion companies, and who gets to put their name and actually profit off of the cool that someone else created.
Yeah. And I think that word profit is really key, that it's not just a you know, a kind of cultural recognition, but it's the you know, actual money that comes with that. You talk about how there's the wealth gap between Black and white Americans exists at every income level, so that even, you know, someone, a white person who's making, you know, $20,000 a year probably still has significantly more wealth than a Black person making $20,000 a year. And that economic disparity is just never really talked about in these discussions about cultural appropriation.
Yeah. And I mean, I still like feel, I like go back and forth on including that study in the introduction of the book. I think when you write a certain type of book, like, you know, packaging is everything, right? So it's not just about like the title that grabs your eye. It's the introduction that like really seizes you and sort of shakes you and says, this is a thing you should pay attention to, continue reading, and kind of sets the tone of the book. And I think the introduction sets and I don't know if you felt this way, I think the introduction kind of sets a different tone than the rest of the book. And I think it was because I needed to write this introduction that, you know, establishes appropriation as like a thing to care about when, you know, the book isn't actually that invested in doing, you know, crunching the numbers on, you know, what kinds of, you know, what wealth is lost in the sort of massive legacy of like enslavement and whatever, because it's, you know, it's an incalculable number, the same way that trying to calculate the losses of fashion labels cribbing from like young Black and brown teens is like also like incalculable. And so I'm not really interested in that like the accounting of it, but it is one of those things that I just have a sense for that we, you know, it isn't immaterial. And so when we were talking about the disparities between a record label or a pop star and just the average person on Instagram, like, yeah, power and wealth and all of that comes into play.
Yeah. You mentioned that you're not a lawyer. You're also not an economist. So it's not, you're not tracing the money. That's not the project of this book.
No, not
at all. It sort of reminded me of the detail in No Logo, Naomi Klein's book, about how, I don't know if they still do this, but in the 90s, sneaker companies used to like send people up to Harlem to just ask random Black teenagers which sneakers they liked, like what of the new, you know, prototypes of sneakers they liked, and just be like, do you like this one? We'll give you whichever one you want for free. And, but like, if they'd been, you know, working as some kind of a consultant, they would have been able to bill, I don't know, hundreds of dollars per hour for those conversations.
Exactly.
The title of your book derives from the Norman Mailer essay, which is like such a bizarre argument that seems like really offensive in some ways and really trenchant in some other ways. It's been a while since I've read the essay, but the takeaway is sort of about how white culture views Black culture as the kind of prototype of cool. And he's thinking about sort of bebop and beat poets and stuff. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, why you wanted to name your book after this essay and kind of how deep this association of Blackness with cool runs among white people?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was, so the essay is like, yeah, so it's like not, I think it's like not what, I just like, I think it's just like one of those things that like, kind of almost like similarly to like Eric Lotz's Love and Theft, though like I have, you know, I don't really want to draw like a comparison between Lotz and like Mailer, this like incredibly, you know, violent, abusive writer, but like I think they're those works are used similarly in the sense that like, so like the White Negro essay, which is first of all very long, like it's always longer than you think. Like I think it's like 9,000 words long or something like that, is like not actually about what I think a lot of people would assume it's about when they either evoke the name or, you know, say it offhand or see the title or whatever. Like he only uses that formulation, like the White Negro, once throughout the entire essay, similar to how people always like to invoke, and I'll include myself in this, Eric Lotz's Love and Theft, as the idea that, like, you know, white people love Black culture so much that they take from it, which is, like, not actually the argument of that study at all, but we don't have to get into that. But back to Mailer, you know, the white Negro essay is, like, really trying to, you know, it's not really about Black people at all. It's really trying to diagnose the sort of shot nerves of this like up and coming youth culture that is like jaded and uninterested in the sort of life that's been laid out for them in the suburbs. They've seen war, they've seen an atomic bomb, they've seen like, you know, and some, you know, in some case, you know, to some extent it's like they are the beneficiaries of the wealth that came out of America's involvement in that war. And yet having seen such devastation are like really uneasy, or at least in Mailer's reading, really uneasy about that inheritance. And so where do they look for, or who do they look to kind of help them through, or at least find a language or a sound to express their existential crisis? Well, of course, they go to the Negro, the person for whom like existential crises like that is the default state of being. To be Black in America is to be constantly in a state of questioning and undermining like your own, like yourself or right to self or being or anything like that. And so that's kind of like his read of like counterculture, of beboppers, of you know, the language of hip and whatnot, is that like, you know, the youths are like going through a tough time, and they're like, well, Black people are always going through a tough time, and this is the music they listen to, and these are their haunts, and sort of molding themselves to that to kind of figure out how to move through life.
And a lot of it's about the atomic bomb, right? It's about this sense of white people suddenly are aware that they could be killed at any moment, and Black people have always known that, right? That's a part of the argument?
Yeah, exactly, totally.
Do you think that he's diagnosing a real cultural shift in the sort of post-war period? Like, do you think that cultural appropriation looks different in the 40s and 50s than it did, I don't know, in the 20s?
I'm no scholar of the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, so I would feel unqualified to necessarily make that sort of assertion. And that's also part of why I kept most of my book in the quote unquote new millennium, because I just thought it would just be an easier, or not an easier task, but I think it would be a more intuitive task that wouldn't require me to either do the sort of like, I don't know, try to make like a historical lineage that maybe doesn't necessarily hold up if you actually go into the literature. Like, I think, yes, obviously there is a conceptual tie between the sort of expropriation of labor that happened during legal enslavement and the kind of extraction of cultural cachet that happens today, in addition to still the, you know, expropriation of unpaid labor. But I just think, you know, the wider your historical scope gets, like the messier things get. And if you, the more you ignore the sort of messier entanglements, like, then, you know, that just like leaves you very vulnerable. And I was like, I don't have time for that. I have to write this book and also write a dissertation. So like, yeah. But you know, of course, I mean, I would say, you know, of course it's different. It has to be, you know, mass culture as we know it is different, and in some ways an invention of the mid 20th century. And so yes, of course it has to be different. I like to say, you know, I've said before that like once upon a time you had to actually like go to the jazz club to like be hip and expose yourself to the, you know, you have to go to the quote unquote seedier part of town, right? Today you can just flip on Instagram and you might not even recognize what you're seeing as Black culture, right? You might be getting it secondhand, third hand through a Kardashian or something like that. And so that mediation, I think, is definitely different and definitely a byproduct of the internet age.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the more recent case studies that do kind of form the core of your book. You have a chapter on pop music, particularly the sort of pop icons of the early 2000s, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera. I feel like cultural appropriation is maybe particularly difficult to navigate for pop music, just because, you know, all American pop music comes from Black people at some level, maybe with the exception of country, though you'd even have people taking exception to that. So could you talk a little bit about how Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears dealt with their debt to Black artists?
So I think the way Well, I guess the way they dealt with their debt is like not at all. That is to say, like, you know, I don't
this
think
this is a theme in your book.
But
or maybe, well, how did they make use of tropes of Black culture? What did Blackness do for them?
Yeah, so for Christina Aguilera, who's the one I focus on the most in the chapter, I thought she had a really interesting, she has a really interesting career arc in that she, or at least as she, you know, she claims she got interested in music and singing and really developed her musical sensibility by listening to R&B records, jazz records, funk records in driving into Philly, I believe, with her grandmother, an older relative or something like that. And you can hear that in the songs that were she chose or were probably chosen for her when she was a cast member on the Mickey Mouse Club, and just coming out with this very, like, I call it like a diva sensibility, which is really just to say like a voice that has been trained itself on the kind of vocal maneuvers of people like Whitney and Toni Braxton and Aretha and all these legends. And you could hear that in the R&B in the R&B sound of her first album. And then there is like this really interesting shift that happens in the Dirty era, her third album, where she is using more of a kind of like hip hop sound. She's having music videos in that like take place in like somewhere in the hoods of NYC. I don't know if it's like the Bronx. I don't know if it's like Crown Heights. Like, I don't know where it is. It's like actually not supposed to be anywhere. It's just like sort of a vaguely brown neighborhood. She's wearing box braids and afros on the red carpet. She's wearing a dark, dark tan where, she, you know, she once was like very fair and had like blonde hair. She dyes her hair black. She's wearing like chaps, and all of this is kind of couched in the language of like teen star rebellion, pop star rebellion, which is a narrative that we've seen over and over again. And it's really interesting that this rebellion also happens to overlap with an interest in collaborating with hip hop artists, with evoking hip hop sounds and doing that whole song and dance, literally. Mm-hmm. And then she takes a break. She comes back. She's all cleaned up, as one of the headlines say, and she is blonde. But like, she is still, you know, it's almost like she's gone back to, ironically, like her roots in the sense that she's going back to that sort of classic R&B diva sound. And so I thought Christina Aguilera was really interesting because she is not Black, but obviously, but her musical sensibility has always been informed by Black artists and Black music in a certain way. And across her career, you can sort of see how that gets utilized in a whole lot of different ways. And so it really goes back to like what you were saying, that, you know, the whole adage that, you know, American music is Black music is American music. Which is true enough, but I also think, you know, to the point about sort of more in-depth conversations at appropriation, like, I want to know, you know, I always want to know how, right? You can say, you know, you can point to a song and say, like, you know, this has roots in Black music, and that very much includes something like country, but I also think it's more interesting to actually trace, okay, where are these certain sounds coming from, especially in pop music, which is so promiscuous in what it borrows from. You know, it'll take steel drums from one place and combine it with like the, I don't know, combine it with like a banjo or something like that. It'll be so, mm-hmm. you know, it's so reckless and formless in a way that I think is really interesting. And I think talking about appropriation in non-punitive ways, we can actually discuss, you know, we actually can discuss where our music that we listen to comes from, instead of just saying this is appropriation and trying to move on.
This isn't someone you talk about in your book, but your book made me think a lot about Lil Nas X and how, you know, Old Town Road in some ways is kind of appropriating in the other direction. And a lot of white country fans were really apoplectic about that, that country music. I mean, if you turn on country music radio today, you're going to hear a lot of hip hop influence. But when an artist rooted in hip hop decides to put a banjo in his song, even if it is a Nine Inch Nails sample, people went kind of crazy.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that was a whole thing. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it all just goes to show that, like, I mean, we all know that genres are kind of fake, or they're only as stable as the rules we give them. So, and that's very much racially inflected. Of course, if you look at, like, the Grammys and what they've been trying to, how they've been trying to skirt giving Black people awards for, like, basically trying to keep Black artists like corralled in these very specific categories, so much that they have to like keep revitalizing like the what, I don't know, urban contemporary, I think it was called, and I think they just changed it again because like they really don't want to let like people like Beyonce, who like uses like a lot of different genres, or someone like, I don't know, Tinashe or someone like that, they really don't want them, you know, up for, they really don't want them outside of this, like, this really amorphous category that they're like, well, you know, it's popular, but it's Black. So, you know, right. urban, whatever. And so, you know, the same thing with country. So it's the same logic that says that, like, a Florida Georgia Line song featuring Bebe Rexha with a trap beat behind it can be eligible for the CMTs and can be eligible for the country music charts and can be the longest running country music song single. I think, you know, I think it broke that record, but Old Town Road, because Black, right, is not eligible for that chart, even though,
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This really kind of speaks to the way that, you know, genres at a certain level do kind of cash out to be about race. I mean, it's hillbilly records and race records, just kind of with a new name. I mean, I don't know what else urban contemporary means other than Black people singing, right?
Like, exactly.
Like, that's the only reason. That's why it's not hip-hop. Like, hip-hop is Black people rapping, and urban contemporary is Black people singing.
Right.
you also write a lot about fashion, and you write that, you know, properly crediting Black influences might mean the end of fashion as we know it. So what do you think, why do you think the fashion industry is so dependent on Black aesthetics?
Because the fashion industry is all about aspirations towards an avant-garde, or what it will accept as avant-garde. And in the history of, like, I don't know, the history of aesthetics, which, like, sounds like such a, that sounds like I'm a philosopher now, which I'm very much not.
Hey, you got your PhD for a reason. Feel free to use the phrase history of aesthetics if you want.
I'll stick mostly with, you know, literature, since that's where I actually qualify. But, like, really in the history of, like, aesthetics and, like, avant-garde, you have people like Picasso and E.E. Cummings, who are all borrowing, you know, not even necessarily from Black language or African art directly, though, of course, there's a lot of that. But really, like, the idea or the sense of something other or different that becomes the sense of the avant-garde. And so that, you know, that, you know, those are, you know, two prominent examples, but that happens over and over again and in American art and letters as well, which is to say that, like, white people do something, white artists do something, and they get applause from it, whether it's sort of nonsense poetry or what have you. And then that becomes boring because, you know, what was avant-garde now goes mainstream, and now it's boring, and now it's like we need something else again. And so with fashion, like, you see a lot of that, a lot of that cycling happen, and you can almost see it more, it's almost more transparent because the fashion industry has these very concrete, like, seasonal schedules. And I actually think it's interesting to see the way that, like, something like high fashion has been disturbed, literally disturbed by, you know, the fashion market, which is like, which is like Kim Kardashian wears it yesterday and it's on Fashion Nova yesterday as well. Like, like that's right, how, that's how quick they work. But fast fashion is also dependent, really dependent on a certain idea of a Black or brown aesthetic. I mean, Fashion Nova is case in point. Like, you look on there and they're both catering to a specific audience, which is to say they're catering to probably what it considers to be an urban market, but it's also catering to, you know, the type of person who would dress up as racially ambiguous on Instagram or something like that. Mm-hmm. But so back to, like, the end of fashion, it's like, if you were, you know, if to feed your sense of edginess, like, requires you to constantly, you know, scrape from, and, you know, it's not always just like Black and brown kids or adults or people like Dapper Dan. It's at just at large, like, people who are beneath the people who get to make decisions, beneath the literal in real life Miranda Priestley's, right? If to sort of revitalize yourself, you're always having to take from people who don't get credit for it. It's like there's no really redeeming that system. It's just like the whole thing has to collapse.
Yeah. And you suggest a similar thing about the art world. And I'm not super familiar with the world of, you know, visual art, but some of the case studies that you write about are just wild. I mean, you write about this character of Donnell Wolford, which is a Black woman character created by a white male artist named Joe Scanlon, basically to make his work seem more interesting. And this seems to be a source of some controversy, but he hasn't been run out of the art world. Could you tell us a little bit more about this project and what he's trying to do and why he's getting away with it?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's getting away with it because, like, the art world is like crazy, and also, like, it is so dark. Like, I was actually afraid to, like, write this chapter because I was just like, it's such a world that is so absent from me. And, like, I'm in academia where, like, you know, you can't be in academia and not be used to, like, the presence of, like, dark money and, like, forces around you, because, mm-hmm. like, that's what keeps the lights on, essentially. But if it's possible to, like, envision, you know, an even, like, darker center of, like, yeah. capital and circulation, and, like, it is that. It is, like, art, the art world is that. Fine arts is, like, very that. Like, when you see...
Like, it's literally, you know, money laundering for war criminals often, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's really. Like, there was a board member of the Whitney who had, like, a company that was making chemical weapons that were being used against Palestinian children or something like that. I mean, it's just... Like, really, yeah, some of the worst people.
Warren Condors had to, he resigned from the Whitney board, but yeah. And there's, I mean, and that's like, I mean, that's like one guy, right?
Right.
So Joe Scanlon, is an artist and a professor, I think at Yale by the time I was writing this, but, just the way that, you know, artists go around, I don't even know if he's still there anymore, but yeah, he created a character named Donald Woodford, who's a Black woman who has her like biography, fictional biography, of course, has like changed over the course of, her creation. But essentially she is like an avatar for other types of works that he's made. So like collages, paintings, and things like that. And so he would like submit her to like she's had a show. She's had like art shows where there'll be stuff on the walls, like stuff in the room and people will come and they'll look at it and it'll be, you know, all the copy will be as if this is a person that actually exists. And he's actually over the years recruited a sort of rotating cast of like Black women artists and performers to actually play the role of Donald Woodford, like in occasions where it has to be, you know, has to play the artist. And so,
right. Doing interviews and press appearances and stuff. Right.
Yeah. And so I think the sort of central drama that I focused on was Donald Woodford's appearance in the Whitney Biennial, where again, it's like, this is like an extended art project on behalf of Scanlon. And yet in the Whitney, like brochure, it's like, she's just listed like any other artist, you know, born 1978 from wherever in Georgia. And it's just like, her art is just like there, sort of unremarked upon, like no bracketing of anything whatsoever. And that's like kind of, I mean, that's kind of like the art world in a nutshell. I mean, I think people like to make fun of, I think we like to make fun of like performance art because, I don't know, because it's just like seems so outside the experience of what mass culture considers art. But I mean, the art world, if you're a certain type of person, like really respects that. And I think for Scanlon, like this is like a kind of performance art. And so because it's art, it is therefore free of certain kinds of criticism.
But he's not being honest about it. It's one thing to say, now I'm going to do a performance where, you know, this person pretends to be Donnell Woolford, but like, I mean, like you said at the Whitney Biennial, it's not like it's, you know, Joe Scanlon as Donnell Woolford. I mean, cultural appropriation aside, he's kind of just lying, right?
Well, I mean, I think that's like, but like that's performance art, right? Like how many, like, is it performance art if you're like going out into the street and saying, this is a performance, this isn't real, this is fake, right? I think part of, I don't work on performance art, so I don't want to step on anyone's toes because I actually don't know that much about it. But I do feel like part of the discipline though is earnestness. And part of the point about the Donna Woolford thing is like, there is an earnestness about art that actually allows it to be very willfully ignorant about the things that actually make the world. And that includes race.
Right, which I think brings us to Dana Schutz and Kenneth Goldsmith, who are two white artists. Dana Schutz is a painter and Kenneth Goldsmith is a poet, who have both made art about sort of Black pain, violence against Black people. And these works have been kind of widely conceived or widely considered to be, you know, very offensive and problematic. Kenneth Goldsmith, you know, made a poem out of was it Trayvon Martin's autopsy report or?
It was Michael Brown's.
Michael Brown. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with these two artists, it seems like maybe contra Joe Scanlon, there does seem to be an intention, a sort of, I don't know, admirable of misguided attention here to kind of draw attention to the problem of white violence against black people. Why do you think that intention got so muddied, and why were these pieces received so critically, at least once they became known outside of the small circles where they were originally circulating?
I mean, when it comes to art, like, I actually kind of don't care what someone's like intention was. I think I don't really approach criticism that way. I don't approach it that way as like a viewer. I might approach it as like in a workshop or as a educator. And when you tell me I was trying to do this with this essay and I'm telling you, you know, well, it succeeded at this thing that you wanted to do and it failed at this thing that you wanted to do. But that's not really criticism necessarily, or at least not to me. And I think especially as, you know, these are not like green, fresh out of art school people. No, these are like celebrated artist and poet, people with like faculty positions
and
like,
like
oodles and oodles like of money behind you. Like, do you know what it takes to like get into like the Whitney? Like, that's like, anyway, but like, that is just, I mean, I actually don't either, but I assume, you don't just like scrape some pennies together and like make a painting and someone's like, oh, that's really cool. But, or, you know, maybe that is how it happened. I don't know. But the point is just that like these people should know better, or should at least they have the time to think about it. Like, it's like if you, and I think it, like someone like Kenneth Goldsmith, I think, likes to be provocative. And so it's not like he couldn't, you know, if we're thinking about intention, like it's not like he couldn't have known that people would probably find the remixing of a like dead black kid's autopsy like controversial, at least, or like, you know, repugnant or shocking or something like that. And so if we're talking about intention, I have to think that's actually part of why he did it. And it has to also do with his method of poetry, which avails itself of all the language there is in that's there, that's out there, right? He doesn't make new language, right? He's always assembling from elsewhere, as like we all actually ultimately are, but he's sort of more.
He's kind of a limit case of that, where, I mean, he has a book where it's literally every word printed in the New York Times on a certain day, printed, put it in the form of a book, right?
Right. And so, again, it's like another case of like, I was like trying to draw a connection to something earlier that I said, but it's like sort of another case of like willful. It's like, you know, the art, because the art is so, you know, above any other concerns, or thinks itself to be above any other concerns. It's just like allows a lot of like willful, like negligence that is actually like totally harmful and like messed up, and also just like not good. Like, I don't think the Emmett Till painting was like a good painting, like just like visually, aesthetically, technically, like, I don't think it was like good. And I think people who are criticizing the painting were also saying that, because a lot of people who are criticizing the painting were also artists or art critics, but that kind of got lost in the conversation over like censorship or whatever. But it's like the painting was bad, and the intention behind it was also like incredibly ignorant. And so it's just like, but it still made it into the Whitney. Like, black artists like they don't get to do like half-baked work and have it show up in like, you know, this vaunted show.
And that's another issue that the Whitney Biennial is like way less black as a percentage than, for example, New York City, right?
Absolutely.
Or even the country as a whole, right? I mean, it's a really tiny percentage of the artists of the show who are black.
Yeah, for sure.
Another area that you write about pretty extensively is the internet, which is an area you're clearly very kind of proficient in. You talk about the intellectual influence of Tumblr on your kind of knowledge of feminism, anti-racism as a young person. Why do you think Black people are so prominently, like, memed? Like, there's this idea of digital blackface that you talk about a bit in the book. Like, what do you think? What's going on there?
Black people have always, so white people, like, really, there's like a profound like misrecognition of affect and emotions when Black people look at white people. And I come at this from like a literary critic and like affect theory perspective. But like, if social scientists like do studies like where, you know, white people are like looking at different like Black children or something like that, and like they're always angry or furious or something like that when like these kids have like neutral faces, which is like has a lot to do with, you know, or says a lot about how kids get treated in the classroom and in the prison to or the school to prison nexus and all of that. That is just to say that I think white people tend to inflate when they see a moving Black figure, tend to inflate what is going on there. So it's not just, you know, we don't get credit for having sort of the subtle emotions that like any other human being would have. And so when it comes to memes and reaction GIFs, it's in online space where it's like not about the sort of subtleties of affective experience, but about doing something loud and big and hilarious and sassy and shady or whatever. I think the reservoir of Black people doing stuff becomes very compelling. I think it also has to do with when it comes to gifts of like, from reality television and movies and sitcoms and things like that. It also ties back into what kinds of media is available or what kind of roles are available for Black actors and what kind of roles they're being asked to play and how inflated they are and how, you know, the sassy best friend and, you know, all of that. And so that all feeds into, especially when you get into things like gift buttons, which are basically attempting to taxonomize and regulate, and similar to the way that when you go to Google search something, it's something that's been predetermined. You know, the results you get are not necessarily the most quote unquote relevant. You know, the same thing with the gift button. The gift button is training you to see a certain amount of availability for the word that you're searching for.
You also write about the viral videos of white people calling the police on Black people doing just innocuous, normal people stuff, like selling water or sitting in Starbucks. And you read about one woman who called the cops on a Black child selling water, and then it later came out that she was the owner of a company that made medical marijuana for pets. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
That's like just right at that intersection of hilarious and depressing. When you watch these videos, are you able to enjoy the kind of comedy and these hysterical overreactions, or is it just too scary for you?
I actually really don't watch the videos. I mean, I think maybe there's like a couple in there that I described and maybe I watched those, but like, I wasn't really that amused by the trend. I understood completely why people were amused by them. Getting to watch something where, you know, the ending, you know, ends in like some sort of like something that feels like maybe not justice, but like just desserts for the person making the phone call. That's like safe to watch. Like, but yeah, I don't, you know, those like videos make me like very anxious, and it's like not actually that funny. And I find it kind of interesting the way like white people metabolize those videos too, because I'm just like, you know, you guys are like, you guys are like essentially deputized cops, and you know, you're laughing at, you know, Permit Patty one day, but like then, you know, white people are just like so quick to call the cops in any other instance too. So it's just like, and it obviously, very obviously didn't actually, you know, laughing at these videos for an entire summer didn't actually transfer into a, like any sort of a large scale awareness on behalf of white people about calling the cops. Right. Which is why, you know, over and over again, we see, not so, you know, not so hilarious endings for a lot of these videos.
You recently wrote an essay expressing some discomfort with the idea of the anti-racist reading list. These things that have been kind of circulating around the internet in the last couple of months and kind of seem to recirculate every time there's some very public incidents of racial violence. And your book, the book we're talking about right now, has recently shown up on some of these lists. I wonder, how has that made you feel?
I kind of just laugh because I know that, like, if the person who's, like, trying to buy my book to, like, I don't know, get woke or something like that is probably going to be in for a rude awakening because, like, my book doesn't really do a lot of, like, you know, it doesn't really do a lot of how-to. It doesn't really do a lot of, like, explaining. Like, I think there's explicating, there's, like, criticism, but, like, I think if white people are looking for the book that's going to be, like, make them feel good about reading about how, you know, bad they are. Like if they're looking for a sort of like masochistic experience, like they're probably not going to get it from my book. So yeah, I mean, if people want to buy my book, like, yes, please buy my book. I would, you know, right. like that. But I just kind of chuckle because I'm just like, you know, my book is not, it's not white fragility. I know, I understand it has two words in the title and one of those words is white, but you know, it's not the same thing at all.
Right. Yeah. I think those, I mean, you write about this a bit in the essay, but those lists are so interesting in that how, in that they really collapse a bunch of very different books from a bunch of very different writers writing across genre into this kind of like one shelf of like the anti-racist book, you know, and it kind of has this equalizing quality.
Yeah. And yeah, just like, it's like genre, it doesn't matter. Like people don't, it's not that people choose to write in certain registers, like for a particular reason. It's just all, you know, it's all anti-racism.
Yeah. Finally, I'd like to ask you a methodological question. So you teach at Northwestern and you also have written for a really incredibly wide range of different outlets from Essence to The New Yorker to Teen Vogue to Paris Review. How do you balance writing for this wide variety of different popular and scholarly audiences?
Well, it helps that a lot of the writing I've done was done when I was in grad school, which is, I mean, so I was fortunate to be in a program that doesn't have, is pretty low on teaching requirements as far as grad students are concerned. I mean, I know I have, you know, friends who go off into programs and are teaching like a full course load, like from day one. But I think UChicago's teaching is a lot more forgiving in that way. And you have a lot of time to, I don't know, sit and ponder. And I was always very restless. And so I like to, even when I was supposed to be just like sitting in like reading, like for comps or something like that, I always kind of wanted to be writing and engaging with what was happening in the world. And so establishing a sort of public writing practice during that time allowed me to be more choosy when I get to be more busy and only take on assignments that I really want. And the fact that I've never had to depend on freelancing to like eat is like a very, you know, is a huge privilege. Because I think if you look at like, you know, I'm very proud of the things I've written and I feel like I've you know, written a lot over the years. But I think if you compare that to like the average freelancer, it's just like, it's like, that's like nothing. It's like child's play. But I mean, you know, as for balancing the two, I think if you are a scholar of the contemporary or anywhere near the contemporary, you know, you always have to be in taking the things around you. And I think writing in, you know, I don't even like to call it public writing, because I'm like, that just like implies, you know, it's so soaked in like academia, like exceptionalism or whatever. But like writing for other types of publications has been not just freeing, but also I think has improved both my academic and non-academic writing in ways that I would have not have gotten just in grad school, or would not even have gotten as a faculty member. One of the things I was thinking about the other day was like, I was more heavily edited in like as a grad student than I think in ordinary circumstances, like grad students, like you really don't get, you know, an interaction with editing in quite the same way, because committees are not, you know, they're not really, most committees are not really line editing your work. Mm-hmm. Or if they do, that happens like way at the later stage, if you're submitting journal articles and things like that. Again, it's like, it's really, you know, you're not getting, you know, you might get, you know, comments about inserting, you know, adding more to your lit review or bulking up here or citing this or like blah, blah, blah. But like on an actual like sentence by sentence level, like you're not, you know, no one's like taking your work and just like ripping it apart. And so that's like been really useful. And a lot of grad students don't take writing classes, which like they totally should, but like, especially in English, because like we all think that like we're like great writers, so like we don't need writing advice or whatever, which is like so not true. But like, but I also like need that sort of like academic space to just like really sit and think with something and research it deeply. And I think that's an inheritance from my time in grad school that I also bring to other sorts of projects that's really important. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't think I'm like that much of an odd fish. I think like I just kind of need both of these types of like ongoing registers of thought, in that I can't really, I just like can't commit to one or the other. Like I need them both.
And in terms of your like your critical voice, your writing voice, does that shift a lot when you're, you know, writing for a scholarly publication versus when you're writing for a more popular audience, or is it always the, you know, more or less the same voice, variations on a theme?
I mean, it's probably variations on the theme. I mean, I think the difference, like, again, with like public facing, quote unquote, public facing publications, is just like, you know, your work goes through probably more rounds of like immediate revision. You're probably going to have, especially for certain publications, like it's not just you and the editor. It's there might be like an editor above that you're working with. There's going to be a fact checker. There's going to be a copy editor. There's going to be people who are checking for, you know, things like house style, which is like can be really rigid and also can be very like fluid, things like that. I think academia like has given me some, you know, I know like when I'm writing for I guess like a strictly sort of academic audience, I can do things like have really long extended subordinate clauses, because I know that, you know, academic audiences will like just deal with that. But also again, like I think learning how to write clearly is also really important as well. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's just variations on the theme. Like, I don't think I ever sit down and I'm just like, okay, writing for, you know, this publication, time to dumb it down, or writing for, you know, writing an article, like time to really like flex on them or whatever. I think I just like, you know, it's really guided by the scale of the work, and they're just like different scales and different ways of working with sometimes the same types of objects.
This book is really funny. There's a lot of like jokes, like really pretty hard jokes. Is that something that you feel comfortable doing in a more academic setting, or is that something you feel like you need to maybe scale back?
I don't know. I mean, I'm so Like, I'm glad you noticed the humor. Evel Ewing blurbed the book and she called me funny. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was like so excited. Cause I don't think I'm like that funny of a person, or like, I feel like I try too hard. And so like, it's just like, that's why I just like admire people in comedy and people who are funny, like so much. Cause I think it's like, that's like the hardest thing in the world is to be funny. I think when I teach, like maybe I probably enter into that try hard space, but like, I feel like I'm always like, at least I'm laughing. I don't know if anyone else is laughing, but, I try to keep it jovial. But you know, I'm just like brand new faculty. So really ultimately I'm just kind of trying to put my head down and learn what's what about this whole thing.
Well, Lauren Michelle Jackson, thanks so much for being on the program. I really enjoyed the book, and anti-racist reading list or no, I encourage everyone to go check out the book and learn more about these issues.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.